inspected and recertified, and he'd receive a thorough lecture on what did and did not constitute a valid emergency. No, there was no need to bother anyone over this. The only ones who would be really interested were the high-forehead types at UNSC Astrophysics, and they could review the data at their leisure. He logged the anomaly and attached it to his hourly update. Ensign Lovell kicked up his boots and reclined, once again feeling perfectly safe in his little corner of the universe. Chapter 16 0300 Hours, July 17, 2542, Military Calendar. UNSC destroyer Iroquois, on routine patrol in the Sigma Octanus star system. Commander Jacob Keyes stood on the bridge of the Iroquois. He leaned against the brass railing and surveyed the stars in the distance. He wished the circumstances of his first command were more auspicious, but experienced officers were in short supply these days, and he had his orders. He walked around the circular bridge, examining the monitors and displays of engine status. He paused at the screen showing the stars fore and aft. He couldn't quite get used to the view of deep space again. The stars were so vivid, and here, so different from the stars near Earth. The Iroquois had rolled out of space dock near Reach, one of the UNSC's primary naval yards, just 3 months ago. They hadn't even installed her AI yet. Like good officers, the elaborate, artificially intelligent computer systems were also in dangerously short supply. Still, Iroquois was fast, well-armored, and armed to the teeth. He couldn't ask for a finer vessel. Unlike the frigates that Commander Keyes had toured on before, the Meriwether Lewis and Midsummer Night, this ship was a destroyer. She was almost as heavy as both those vessels combined, but she was only 7 meters longer. Some in the fleet thought the massive ships were unwieldy in combat, too slow and cumbersome. What those critics forgot was that a UNSC destroyer sported 2 MAC guns, 26 oversized Archer missile pods, and 3 nuclear warheads. Unlike other fleet ships, she carried no single-ship fighters. Instead, her extra mass came from the nearly 2 meters of titanium A battle plate armor that covered her from stem to stern. The Iroquois could dish out and take a tremendous amount of punishment. Someone at the shipyard had appreciated the Iroquois for what she was, too. 2 long streaks of crimson war paint had been applied to her port and starboard flanks. Strictly non-regulation, and it would have to go. But secretly, Commander Keyes liked the ornamentation. He sat in the commander's chair and watched his junior officers at their stations.
"Incoming transmissions," Lieutenant Dominique reported. "Status reports from Sigma Octanus IV and also the Archimedes sensor outpost."
"Pipe them through to my monitor," Commander Keyes said.
Dominique had been one of his students at the academy. He had transferred to Luna from the Université de l'Astrophysique in Paris after his sister was killed in action. He was short, nimbly athletic, and he rarely cracked a smile. He was always business. Keyes appreciated that. Commander Keyes was less impressed, however, with the rest of his bridge officers. Lieutenant Hikawa managed the weapons console. Her long fingers and slender arms slowly checked the status of the ordnance with all the deliberation of a sleepwalker. Her dark hair was always falling into her eyes, too. Oddly, her record showed that she had survived several battles with the Covenant, so perhaps her lack of enthusiasm was merely battle fatigue. Lieutenant Hall stood posted ops. She seemed competent enough. Her uniform was always freshly pressed, her blonde hair trimmed exactly at the regulation 16 centimeters. She had authored 7 physics papers on slipspace communications. The only problem was that she was always smiling and trying to impress him, occasionally by showing up her fellow officers. Keyes disapproved of such displays of ambition. Manning navigation, however, was his most problematic officer, Lieutenant Jaggers. It might have been that navigation was the commander's strong suit, so anyone else in that position never seemed to be up to par. On the other hand, Lieutenant Jaggers was moody and when Keyes had come aboard, the man's small hazel eyes seemed glazed. He could have sworn he had caught the man on duty with the liquor on his breath, too. He had ordered a blood test. The results were negative.
"Orders, sir?" Jagger asked. "Continue on this heading, Lieutenant. We'll finish our patrol around Sigma Octanus and then accelerate and enter slipspace."
"Aye, sir."
Commander Keyes eased into his seat and detached the tiny monitor from the armrest. He read the hourly report from the Archimedes sensor outpost. The log of the large mass was curious. It was too big to be even the largest Covenant carrier. Yet something was oddly familiar about its shape. He retrieved his pipe from his jacket, lit it, inhaled a puff, and exhaled the fragrant smoke through his nose. Keyes would never even have thought about smoking on the other vessels he had served on, but here, well, command had its privileges. He pulled up his files transferred from the academy. Several theoretical papers that had recently caught his interest. One, he thought, might apply to the outpost's unusual reading. That paper had initially sparked his interest because of its author. He had never forgotten his first assignment with Dr. Catherine Halsey, nor the names of any of the children they had observed. He opened the file and read. United Nations Space Command Astrophysics Journal, 034-23-01. Date, May 97, 2540, military calendar. Encryption code, none. Public key, N.A. Authors, Lieutenant Commander Fahajad, 034. Service number classified, UNSC Office of Naval Intelligence. Subject, dimensional mass space compressions in Sha Fukuzawa, a.k.a. slipstream, space. Classification, N.A. Start file. Abstract. The space-bending properties of mass in normal space are well described by Einstein's general relativity. Such distortions, however, are complicated by the anomalous quantum gravitational effects in Sha-Fukuzawa SF spaces. Using loop-string analysis, it can be shown that a large mass bends space in SF space more than general relativity predicts by an order of magnitude. This bending may explain how several small objects clustered closely together in SF space have been reported erroneously as a single larger mass. Press Enter to continue. Commander Keyes switched back to the silhouette from the Archimedes report. The leading edge almost looked like the bulbous head of a whale. That realization chilled him to the core. He quickly opened the UNSC database of all known Covenant ships. He scanned them until he found the three-dimensional representation of one of their medium-sized warships. He rotated it into three-quarters profile. He overlaid the image on the silhouette, scaled it back a little. It was a perfect match.
"Lieutenant Dominique, get Fleetcom ASAP, Priority Alpha."
The lieutenant snapped straight in his chair.
"Yes, sir."
The bridge officers looked at the commander, then exchanged glances with one another. Commander Keyes brought up a map of the system on his data pad. The silhouette monitored by the outpost was on a direct course for Sigma Octanus 4. That confirmed his theory.
"Bring us about to course 047, Lieutenant Jaggers. Lieutenant Hall, push the reactors to 110%.
"Aye, Commander," Lieutenant Jaggers replied.
"Reactor running hot, sir," Hall reported. "Now exceeding recommended operational parameters."
"ETA?"
Jaggers calculated, then looked up.
43 minutes, he replied.
"Too slow," Commander Keyes muttered. "Reactor to 130%, Lieutenant Hall."
She hesitated.
"Sir?"
"Do it."
"Yes, sir."
She moved as if someone had electrically shocked her.
"Fleet come online, sir,"
Lieutenant Dominique said. The weathered face of Admiral Michael Stanforth appeared on the main view screen. Commander Keyes breathed a sigh of relief. Admiral Stanforth had a reputation for being reasonable and intelligent. He'd understand the logic of the situation.
"Commander Keyes," the Admiral said. "The old schoolmaster himself, huh? This is the priority channel, son. This better be an emergency."
Commander Keyes ignored the obvious condescension. He knew many at Fleetcom thought he deserved to command nothing but a classroom, and some probably thought he didn't deserve that.
The Sigma Octana system is about to come under attack, sir.
Admiral Stanforth cocked an eyebrow and leaned closer to the screen.
I'm requesting that all ships in system rendezvous with the Iroquois at Sigma Octanus IV, and any ships in neighboring systems make best speed here.
Show me what you've got, Keyes, the Admiral said.
Commander Keyes displayed the silhouette from the sensor outpost first.
Covenant ship, sir. Their silhouettes are overlapped. Our probes resolve them as one mass because slipspace is bent by gravity more easily than normal space.
The Admiral listened to his analysis, frowning.
You've fought the Covenant, sir. You know how precisely they can maneuver their ships through the slipstream. I've seen a dozen alien craft appear in normal space in perfect formation, not a kilometer apart.
Yeah, the Admiral muttered. I've seen that, too. All right, Keyes, good work. You'll get everything we can send.
Thank you, sir.
You just hang in there, son. Good luck. Fleetcom out.
The view screen snapped off.
Sir?
Lieutenant Hall turned around.
How many Covenant ships?
I'd estimate 4 medium-tonnage vessels, he said. The equivalent of our frigates.
4 Covenant ships? Lieutenant Jaggers muttered. What can we do?
Do?
Commander Keyes said.
Our duty.
Begging the commander's pardon, but there are 4 cov... Jaggers began to protest. Keyes cut him off with a glare.
Stow that, mister!
He paused, weighing his words.
Sigma Octanus IV has 17 million citizens, Lieutenant. Are you suggesting that we just stand by and watch the Covenant glass the planet?
No, sir.
His gaze dropped to the deck.
We will do the best we can, Commander Keyes said. In the meantime, remove all weapon system locks, order missile crews to readiness, warm up the MAC guns, and remove the safeties from one of our nukes.
Yes, sir,
Lieutenant Hikawa said. An alarm sounded at ops.
Reactor hysteresis approaching failure levels, Lieutenant Hall reported. Superconducting magnets overloading. Cooling breakdown imminent.
Vent primary coolant and pump in the reserve tanks, Commander Keyes ordered. That'll buy us another 5 minutes.
Yes, sir.
Commander Keyes fumbled with his pipe. He didn't bother to light the thing, just chewed on the end. Then he put it away. The nervous habit wasn't setting the right example for his bridge officers. He didn't have the luxury of showing his apprehension. The truth was, he was terrified. 4 Covenant ships would be an even match for 7 destroyers. The best he could hope for was to get their attention and outrun them, hopefully distract them until the fleet got here. Of course, those Covenant ships could outrun the Iroquois as well.
Lieutenant Jaggers, he said. Initiate the Cole Protocol. Purge our navigation databases and then generate an appropriate randomized exit vector from the Sigma Octanus system.
Yes, sir.
He fumbled with his controls. He hung his head, steadied his hands, and slowly typed in the commands.
Lieutenant Hall, make preparations to override reactor safeties.
His junior officers all paused for a second.
Aye, sir,
Lieutenant Hall whispered.
We are receiving a transmission from the system's edge, Lieutenant Dominique announced. Frigates Alliance and Gettysburg are on an inbound vector at maximum speed. ETA 1 hour.
Good,
Commander Keyes said. That hour might as well be a month. This battle would be over in minutes. He could not fight the enemy. He was severely outgunned. He couldn't outrun them either. There had to be another option. Hadn't he always told his students that when you were out of options, then you were using the wrong tactics? You had to bend the rules, shift perspective, anything to find a way out of a hopeless situation. The black space near Sigma Octanus IV boiled and frothed with motes of green light.
Ships entering normal space,
Lieutenant Jaggers announced, panic tinging his voice. Commander Keyes got to his feet. He had been wrong. There weren't 4 Covenant frigates. A pair of enemy frigates emerged from slipspace, escorting a destroyer and a carrier. His blood ran cold. He had seen battles in which a Covenant destroyer had made Swiss cheese of UNSC ships. Its plasma torpedoes could boil through the Iroquois' 2 meters of Titanium A battle plate in seconds. Their weapons were light years ahead of the UNSC's.
Their weapons, Commander Keyes muttered under his breath. Yes, he did have a third option.
Continue at emergency speed, he ordered, and come about to heading 032.
Lieutenant Jaggers swiveled in his seat.
That will put us on a collision course with their destroyer, sir.
I know, Commander Keyes replied. In fact, I'm counting on doing just that.
Chapter 17 0320 hours, July 17th, 2542, military calendar. UNSC Iroquois, en route to Sigma Octanus IV. Commander Keyes stood with his hands behind his back and tried to look calm. Not an easy thing to do when his ship was on a collision course with a Covenant battle group. Inside, adrenaline raced through his blood and his pulse pounded. He had to at least appear in control for his crew. He was asking a lot from them. Probably everything, in fact. His junior officers watched their status monitors. They occasionally glanced nervously at him, but their gazes always drifted back to the center view screen. The Covenant ships looked like toys in the distance. It was dangerous to think of them as harmless, however. One slip, one underestimation of their tremendous firepower, and the Iroquois would be destroyed. The alien carrier had 3 bulbous sections. Its swollen center had 13 launch bays. Commander Keyes had seen hundreds of fighters stream out of them before. Fast, accurate, and deadly craft. Normally, his ship's AI would handle point defense. Only this time, there was no AI installed on the Iroquois. The alien destroyer was a third again as massive as the Iroquois. She bristled with pulse laser turrets, insect-like antenna, and chitinous pods. The carrier and destroyer moved together, but not toward Iroquois. They slowly drifted in-system toward Sigma Octanus IV. Were they going to ignore him? Glass the planet without even bothering to swat him out of the way first? The Covenant frigates, however, lagged behind. They turned in unison, and their sides faced the Iroquois, preparing for a broadside. Motes of red light appeared and swarmed toward the frigate's lateral lines, building into a solid stripe of hellish illumination.
"Detecting high levels of beta particle radiation," Lieutenant Dominique said. "They're getting ready to fire their plasma weapons, Commander."
"Course correction, sir?"
Lieutenant Jaggers asked. His fingers tapped in a new heading bound out system.
"Stay on course."
It took all Commander Keyes's concentration to say that matter-of-factly. Lieutenant Jaggers turned and started to speak, but Commander Keyes didn't have time to address his concerns.
"Lieutenant Hakawa," Commander Keyes said, "arm a Shiva missile. Remove all nuclear launch safety locks."
"Shiva armed. Aye, Commander."
Lieutenant Hakawa's face was a mask of grim determination.
"Set the fuse on radio transmission code sequence detonation only. Disable proximity fuse. Stand by for a launch pilot program."
"Sir?"
Lieutenant Hakawa looked confused by his order, but then said,
"Sir, yes, sir, making it happen."
The alien frigates in the center of the view screen no longer looked remotely like toys to Commander Keyes. They looked real and larger every second. The red glow along their sides had become solid bands, almost too bright to look directly at. Commander Keyes picked up his data pad and quickly tapped in calculations, velocity, mass, and heading. He wished they had an AI online to double-check his figures. This amounted to no more than an educated guess. How long would it take the Iroquois to orbit Sigma Octanus IV? He got a number and cut it by 60%, knowing they'd either pick up speed or be dead by the time it mattered.
"Lieutenant Hakawa, set the Shiva's course for Mark 180. Full burn for 12 seconds.
"Isa,"
she said, tapped in the parameters and locked them into the system.
"Missile ready, sir."
"Sir."
Lieutenant Jaggers swiveled around and stood. His lips were drawn into a tight, thin line.
That course fires the missile directly away from our enemies.
I'm aware of that, Lieutenant Jaggers. Sit down and await further orders.
Lieutenant Jaggers sat. He rubbed his temple with a trembling hand. His other hand balled into a fist. Commander Keyes linked to the nav system and set a countdown timer on his data pad. 29 seconds.
On my mark, Lieutenant Hakawa, launch that nuke, and not a moment before.
Isa!
Her slender hand hovered over the control panel.
Mac guns are still hot, Commander,
she reminded him.
Divert the energy, keeping the capacitors at full charge, and route them to the engines, Commander Keyes ordered.
Lieutenant Hall said,
Diverting now, sir.
She exchanged a glance with Lieutenant Hakawa.
Engines now operating at 150% of rated output. Red line in 2 minutes.
Contact! Contact!
Lieutenant Dominique shouted.
Enemy plasma torpedoes away, sir!
Scarlet lightning erupted from the alien frigates. Twin bolts of fire streaked through the darkness. They looked as if they could burn space itself. The torpedoes were on a direct course for the Iroquois.
Course correction, sir?
Lieutenant Jagger's voice broke with strain. His uniform was soaked with perspiration.
Negative, Commander Keyes replied. Continue on this heading. Arm all aft Archer missile pods. Rotate launch arcs 180 degrees.
Isa!
Lieutenant Hakawa wrinkled her brow, and then she slowly nodded and silently mouthed, Yes. Boiling red plasma filled half the forward viewscreen. It was beautiful to watch in an odd way, like a front-row seat at a forest fire. Keyes found himself strangely calm. This would either work, or it would not. The odds were long, but he was confident that his actions were the only option to survive this encounter. Lieutenant Dominique turned.
Collision with plasma in 19 seconds, sir.
Jaggers turned from his station.
Sir, this is suicide. Our armor can't withstand—
Keyes cut him off.
Mister, man your station or I will have you removed from the bridge.
Jaggers looked pleadingly at Hakawa.
We're gonna die, Aki!
She refused to meet his gaze and turned back to her controls.
You heard the commander, she said quietly. Man your post.
Jaggers sank into his seat.
Collision with plasma in 7 seconds,
Lieutenant Hall said. She bit her lower lip.
Lieutenant Jaggers, transfer emergency thruster controls to my station.
Yes, yes, sir.
The emergency thrusters were tanks of trihydride tetrazine and hydrogen peroxide. When they mixed, they did so with explosive force, literally blasting the Iroquois onto a new course. The ship had 6 such tanks strategically placed on hardened points on the hull. Commander Keyes consulted the countdown timer on his data pad.
Lieutenant Hakawa, fire the nuke!
Shiva away, sir. On course. 180 maximum burn.
Plasma filled the forescreen. The center of the red mass turned blue. Greens and yellows radiated outward. The light frequencies blue shifting in spectra.
Distance 300,000 kilometers,
Lieutenant Dominique said.
Collision in 2 seconds.
Commander Keyes waited a heartbeat, then hit the emergency thrusters to port. A bang resonated through the ship's hull. Commander Keyes flew sideways and impacted with a bulkhead. The viewscreen was full of fire, and the bridge was suddenly hot. Commander Keyes stood. He counted the beats of his pounding heart. 1, 2, 3. If they had been hit by the plasma, there wouldn't be anything to count. They would be dead already. Only one viewscreen was working now, however.
Aft camera, he said.
The twin blots of fire streaked along their trajectories for a moment, then lazily arced, continuing their pursuit of the Iroquois. One pulled slightly ahead of its counterpart, so they appeared now like 2 blazing eyes. Commander Keyes marveled at the alien's ability to direct that plasma from such a great distance.
Good, he muttered to himself. Chase us all the way to hell, you bastards.
Track them,
he ordered Lieutenant Hall.
Aye, sir,
she said. Her perfectly groomed hair was tousled.
Plasma increasing velocity, matching our speed. overtaking our velocity now. They will intercept in 43 seconds.
Forward camera, Commander Keyes ordered.
The view screen flashed. The image changed to show the two alien frigates turning to face the incoming Iroquois head-on. Blue lights flickered along their hulls, pulse lasers charging. Commander Keyes pulled back the camera angle and saw the alien carrier and the destroyer was still inbound towards Sigma Octanus IV. He read their position off his data pad and quickly performed the necessary calculations.
Course correction, he told Lieutenant Jaggers. Come about to heading 004.25. Declination 000.18.
Aye, sir, Jaggers said. 004.25. Declination 000.18.
The view screen turned and centered on the enormous Covenant destroyer.
Collision course, Lieutenant Hull announced. Impact with Covenant destroyer in 8 seconds.
Stand by for new course correction. Declination minus 000.10.
Aye, sir.
As Jaggers typed, he wiped the sweat from his eyes and double-checked his numbers.
Course online. Awaiting your order, sir.
Collision with Covenant destroyer in 5 seconds,
Hull said. She clutched the edge of her seat. The destroyer grew in the view screen. Laser turrets and launch bays, bulbous alien protrusions and flickering blue lights.
Hold this course, Commander Keyes said. Sound collision alarm. Switch to undercarriage camera now.
Klaxons blared. The view screen snapped off and on and showed black space, then a flash of the faint purple-blue hull of a Covenant ship. The Iroquois screeched and shuddered as she grazed the prow of the Covenant destroyer. Silver shields flickered on screen. Then the screen filled with static.
Course correction now! Commander Keyes shouted.
Hi, sir.
There was a brief burn from the thrusters, and the Iroquois nudged down slightly.
Hull breach, Lieutenant Hull said. Ceiling pressure doors.
Aft camera, Commander Keyes said. Guns, fire aft Archer missile pods.
Missiles away,
Lieutenant Hakawa replied. Keyes watched as the first of the plasma torpedoes that had been trailing the Iroquois impacted on the prow of the alien destroyer. The ship's shields flared, flickered, and vanished. The second bolt hit a moment later. The hull of the alien ship blazed and then turned red-hot, melted, and boiled. Secondary explosions burst through the hull. The Archer missiles streaked toward the wounded Covenant ship, tiny trails of exhaust stretching from the Iroquois to the target. They slammed into the gaping wounds in the hull and detonated. Fire and debris burst from the destroyer. A smile spread across Key's face as he watched the alien ship burn, list, and slowly plunge into Sigma Octanus IV's gravity well. Without power, the Covenant vessel would burn up in the planet's atmosphere. Commander Keyes flicked on the intercom.
Brace for emergency thruster maneuver!
He punched the thruster controls. Explosive force detonated on the starboard side of the ship. The Iroquois nosed towards Sigma Octanus IV.
Course correction, Lieutenant Jaggers, he said. Bring us into a tight orbit.
Aye, sir.
He furiously tapped in commands, diverting engine output through altitude thrusters. The hull of the Iroquois glowed red as it entered the atmosphere. A cloud of yellow ionization built up around the view screen. Commander Keyes gripped the railing tighter. The view screen cleared, and he could see the stars. The Iroquois entered the dark side of the planet. Commander Keyes slumped forward and started breathing again.
Engine coolant failure, sir, Lieutenant Hull said.
Shut the engines down, he ordered. Emergency vent.
Aye, sir. Venting fusion reactor plasma.
The Iroquois was abruptly quiet. No rumble of her engines. And no one said anything until Lieutenant Hakawa stood and said,
Sir, that was the most brilliant maneuver I have ever seen.
Commander Keyes gave a short laugh.
You think so, Lieutenant?
If one of his students had proposed such a maneuver in his tactics class, he would have given them a C+. He would have told them their maneuver was full of bravado and daring, but extremely risky, placing the crew and the ship in unnecessary danger.
This isn't over yet. Stay sharp, he told them. Lieutenant Hakawa, what is the charge status of the MAC guns?
Capacitors at 95%, sir, and draining at a rate of 3% per minute.
Ready MAC guns, one heavy round apiece. Arm all forward Archer missile pods.
Aye, sir.
The Iroquois broke free of the dark side of Sigma Octanus IV.
Fire chemical thrusters to break orbit, Lieutenant Hall.
Firing, aye.
There was a brief rumble. The screen centered on the backsides of the two Covenant frigates they had passed on the way in. The alien ships started to come about. Blue flashes flickered along their hulls as their laser turrets charged. Motes of red collected along their lateral lines. They were readying another salvo of plasma torpedoes. There was something there, however, that was too small to see on the viewscreen. The nuke. Keyes had launched that missile in the opposite direction, but its reverse thrust had not completely overcome their tremendous forward velocity. As the Iroquois had screamed over the prow of the destroyer, and as they orbited Sigma Octanus IV, the nuke had drifted closer to the frigates, who had fixed their attention solidly on the Iroquois. Commander Keyes tapped his data pad and sent the signal to detonate the bomb. There was a flash of white, a crackle of lightning, and the alien ships vanished as a cloud of destruction enveloped them. Waves of the EMP interacted with the magnetic field of Sigma Octanus IV, rippled with Rainbow Borealis. The cloud of vapor expanded and cooled, and faded to yellow, orange, red, then black dust that scattered into space. Both Covenant frigates, however, were still intact. Their shields, however, flickered once, then went dead.
Give me firing solutions for the MAC guns, Lieutenant Hakawa, on the double.
Aye, sir. MAC gun capacitors at 93%. Firing solution online.
Fire, Lieutenant Hakawa!
Two thumps resonated through the hull of the Iroquois.
Lock remaining Archer missile pods on targets and fire!
Missiles away, Commander.
Twin thunderbolts and hundreds of missiles streaked toward the two helpless frigates. The MAC rounds tore through them. One ship was holed from nose to tail. The other ship was hit on her midline, right near the engines. Internal explosions chained up the length of the ship, bulging the second ship's hull along her length. Archer missiles impacted seconds later, exploding through chunks of hull and armor, tearing the alien ships apart. The frigate that had taken the MAC round in her engines mushroomed, a fireworks bouquet of shrapnel and sparks. The other ship burned, her internal skeletal structure showing now. She turned toward the Iroquois, but didn't fire a weapon. Just drifted out of control, dead in space.
Position of the Covenant carrier, Lieutenant Hall?
Lieutenant Hall paused, then reported,
in polar orbit around Sigma Octanus IV, but she's moving off at considerable speed. Headed out system, course 045.
Alert the Allegiance and the Gettysburg of her position.
Commander Keyes sighed and slumped back into his chair. They had stopped the Covenant ships from glassing the planet, saved millions of lives. They had done the impossible, taken on four Covenant ships and won. Commander Keyes paused in his self-congratulation. Something was wrong. He had never seen the Covenant run. In every battle he had seen or read about, they stayed to slaughter every last survivor. Or if they were defeated, they always fought to the last ship.
Check the planet, he told Lieutenant Hall. Look for anything. Dropped weapons, strange transmissions. There's gotta be something there.
Aye, sir.
Keyes prayed she wouldn't find anything. At this point he was out of tricks. He couldn't turn the Iroquois around and return to Sigma Octanus IV even if he had wanted to. The Iroquois' engines were down for a long time. They were speeding on an out-system vector at a considerable velocity. And even if they could stop, there was no way to recharge the MAC guns and no remaining Archer missiles. They were practically dead in space. He pulled out his pipe and steadied his shaking hand.
Sir! Lieutenant Hall cried. Dropship, sir! The alien carrier deployed 34 dropships. I have silhouettes descending to the surface. They're on course for Côte d'Azur, a major population center.
An invasion, Commander Keyes said. Get Fleetcom ASAP. Time to send in the Marines.
Chapter 18 0600 hours, July 18, 2542, military calendar. UNSC Iroquois, military staging area, in orbit around Sigma Octanus IV. Commander Keyes had a sinking feeling that although he had won the battle, it would be the first of many to come in the Sigma Octanus system. He watched the 4 dozen other UNSC ships orbit the planet, frigates and destroyers, 2 carriers, and a massive repair and refitting station. More vessels than Admiral Cole had at his disposal during his 4-year-long campaign to save Harvest. Admiral Stanforth had pulled out all the stops. Although Commander Keyes was grateful for the quick and overwhelming response, he wondered why the Admiral had dedicated so many ships to the area. Sigma Octanus wasn't strategically positioned. It had no special resources. True, the UNSC had standing orders to protect civilian lives, but the fleet was spread dangerously thin. Commander Keyes knew there were more valuable systems that needed protection. He pushed these thoughts aside. He was sure Admiral Stanforth had his reasons. Meanwhile, the repair and resupply of the Iroquois was his top priority. He didn't want to get caught half-ready if the Covenant returned. Or rather, when they returned. It was a curious thing, the aliens dropping their ground forces and then retreating. That was not their usual mode of operation. Commander Keyes suspected this was just an opening move in a game he didn't yet understand. A shadow crossed the 4 camera of the Iroquois as the repair station Cradle maneuvered closer. Cradle was essentially a large square plate with engines. Large was an understatement. She was over a square kilometer. 3 destroyers could be eclipsed by her shadow. The station running at full steam could refit 6 destroyers, 3 from her lower surface, and 3 on her upper surface, within a matter of hours. Scaffolds deployed from her surfaces to facilitate repairs. Resupply tubes, hoses, and cargo trams fed into the Iroquois. It would take the full attention of Cradle 30 hours to repair the Iroquois, however. The aliens had not landed a single serious shot. Nonetheless, the Iroquois had almost been destroyed during the execution of what some in the fleet were already calling the Keyes Loop. Commander Keyes glanced at his datapad and the extensive list of repairs. 15% of the electronic systems had to be replaced. Burned out from the EMP when the Shiva missile detonated. The Iroquois' engines required a full overhaul. Both coolant systems had valves that had been fused from the tremendous heat. 5 of the superconducting magnets had to be replaced as well. But most troublesome was the damage to the underside of the Iroquois. When they had told Commander Keyes what had happened, he went outside in a long-sword interceptor to personally inspect what he had done to his ship. The underside of the Iroquois had been scraped when they passed over the prow of the alien destroyer. He knew there was some damage, but was not prepared for what he saw. UNSC destroyers had nearly 2 meters of titanium A battle plate on their surfaces. Commander Keyes had abraded through all of it. He had breached every bottom deck of the Iroquois. The jagged, serrated edges of the plate curled away from the wound. Men in EVA thruster packs were busy cutting off the damaged sections so new plates could be welded into place. The underside was mirror smooth and perfectly flat. But Keyes knew that the appearance of benign flatness was deceptive. Had the angle of the Iroquois been tilted a single degree down, the force of the 2 ships impacting would have shorn his ship in half. The red war stripes that had been painted on the Iroquois' side looked like bloody slashes. The dockmaster had privately told Commander Keyes that his crew could buff the paint off, or even repaint the war stripes if he wanted. Commander Keyes had politely refused the offer. He wanted them left exactly the way they were. He wanted to be reminded that while everyone had admired what he had done, it had been an act of desperation, not heroism. He wanted to be reminded of how close a brush he had had with death. Commander Keyes returned to the Iroquois and marched directly to his quarters. He sat at his antique oak desk and tapped the intercom.
Lieutenant Dominique, you have the bridge for the next cycle. I am not to be disturbed.
Aye, Commander. Understood.
Commander Keyes loosened his collar and unbuttoned his uniform. He retrieved the 70-year-old bottle of scotch that his father had given him from the bottom drawer, and then poured 4 centimeters into a plastic cup. He had to attend to an even more unpleasant task. What to do about Lieutenant Jaggers? Jaggers had exhibited borderline cowardice, insubordination, and come within a hairbreadth of attempted mutiny during the engagement. Keyes could have had him court-martialed. Every reg in the books screamed at him to. But he didn't have it in him to send the young man before a board of inquiry. He would instead merely transfer the lieutenant to a place where he would still do the UNSC some good, perhaps a distant outpost. Was all the blame his? As commander, it was his responsibility to maintain control, to prevent a crewman from even thinking that mutiny was a possibility. He sighed. Maybe he should have told his crew what he was attempting, but there had simply been no time. And certainly no time for discussion, as Jaggers would have wanted. No, the other bridge officers had concerns, but they had followed his orders, as their duty required. As much as Commander Keyes believed in giving people a second chance, this was where he drew the line. To make matters worse, transferring Jaggers would leave a hole in the bridge crew. Commander Keyes accessed the service records of Iroquois' junior officers. There were several who might qualify for navigation officer. He flipped through their files on his data pad, and then paused. The theoretical paper on mass space compression was still open, as well as his hastily calculated course corrections. He smiled and archived those notes. He might one day give a lecture on this battle at the academy. It would be useful to have the original source material. There was also the data from the Archimedes sensor outpost. That report had been thoroughly made. Clean data graphs and a navigational course plotted for the object through slipstream space. Not an easy task even with an AI. The report even had tags to route it to the astrophysics section of the UNSC. Thoughtful. He looked up the service record of the officer who had filed the report. Ensign William Lovell. Keyes leaned closer. The boy's career service vitae was almost twice as long as his own. He had volunteered and been accepted at Luna Academy. He transferred in his second year, having already received a commission to ensign for heroism in a training flight that had saved the entire crew. He took duty on the first outbound corvette headed into battle. 3 bronze stars, a silver cluster, and 2 purple hearts, and he had catapulted to a full lieutenant within 3 years. Then something went terribly wrong. Lovell's decline in the UNSC had been as rapid as his ascent. 4 reports of insubordination, and he was busted to second lieutenant and transferred 2x. An incident with a civilian woman. No details in the files, although Commander Keyes wondered if the girl listed in the report, Anna Jeroff, was Vice Admiral Jeroff's daughter. He had been reassigned to the Archimedes sensor outpost, and had been there for the last year, an unheard-of length of time in such a remote facility. Commander Keyes reviewed the logs when Lovell had been on duty. They were careful and intelligent, so the boy was still sharp. Was he hiding? There was a gentle knock on his door.
"Lieutenant Dominique, I said I was not to be disturbed."
"Sorry to intrude, son," said a muffled voice.
The pressure door's wheel turned, and Admiral Stanforth stepped inside.
"But I thought I'd just stop by since I was in the neighborhood."
Admiral Stanforth was much smaller in person than he appeared on screen. His back was stooped over with age, and his white hair was thinning at the crown. Still, he exuded a reassuring air of authority that Keyes instantly recognized.
"Sir!"
Commander Keyes stood at attention, knocking over his chair.
"At ease, son."
The admiral looked around his quarters, and his gaze lingered a moment on the framed copy of LaGrange's original manuscript in which he derived his equations of motion.
"You can pour me a few fingers of the whiskey if you can spare it."
"Yes, sir."
Keyes fumbled with another plastic cup and poured the admiral a drink. Stanforth took a sip,
then sighed appreciatively.
Very nice.
Keyes righted his chair and offered it to the Admiral. He sat down and leaned forward.
I wanted to congratulate you personally on the miracle you performed here, Keyes.
Sir, I don't... Stanforth held up a finger.
Don't interrupt me, son. That was a hell of a piece of astrogation you pulled off. People noticed. Not to mention the morale boost it's given to the entire fleet.
He took another sip of the liquor and exhaled.
Now that's the reason we're all here. We need a victory. It's been too damn long. Us getting whittled to pieces by those alien bastards. So this has got to be a win, no matter what it takes.
I understand, sir, Commander Keyes said. He knew morale had been sagging for years throughout the UNSC. No military, no matter how well trained, could stomach defeat after defeat without it affecting their determination in battles.
How's it going planetside?
Right now, don't you worry about that.
Admiral Stanforth eased back in his chair, balancing on two legs.
General Kitts has his troops down there. They've got the surrounding cities evacuated, and they'll be assaulting Côte d'Azur within the hour. They'll pace those aliens faster than you can spit. You just watch.
Of course, sir.
Commander Keyes looked away.
You got something else to say, boy? Spit it out.
Well, sir, this isn't the way the Covenant normally operates. Dropping an invasion force and leaving the system, they either slaughter everything or die trying. This is something altogether different.
Admiral Stanforth waved a dismissive hand.
You leave trying to figure out what those aliens are thinking to the spooks in O&I, son. Just get the Iroquois patched up and fit for duty again. And you let me know if you need anything.
Stanforth knocked back the last of his whiskey and stood.
Got to marshal the fleet.
Oh,
he paused.
One more thing.
He dug into his jacket pocket and retrieved a tiny cardboard box. He set it on the commander's desk.
Consider it official. The paperwork will catch up with us soon enough.
Commander Keyes opened the box. Inside were a pair of brass collar insignia, four bars and a single star.
Congratulations, Captain Keyes.
The Admiral snapped a quick salute, then held out his hand. Keyes managed to grasp and shake the Admiral's hand. The insignia was real. He was stunned. He couldn't say anything.
You've earned it.
The Admiral started to turn.
Give me a shout if you need anything.
Yes, sir.
Keyes stared at the brass star and stripes a moment longer, then finally tore his gaze away.
Admiral, there is one thing. I need a replacement navigation officer.
Admiral Stanforth's relaxed posture stiffened.
I heard about that. Ugly business when a bridge officer loses their stomach. Well, you just say the candidate's name and I'll make sure you get him. As long as you're not pulling him off my ship, he smiled. Keep up the good work, Captain.
Sir,
Captain Keyes saluted. The Admiral stepped out and closed the door. Keyes practically fell into his chair. He had never dreamed they'd make him a captain. He turned the brass insignia over in his palm and replayed his conversation with Admiral Stanforth in his mind. He had said, Captain Keyes. Yes, this was real. The Admiral had also brushed aside his concerns about the Covenant too quickly. Something didn't quite add up. Keyes clicked on the intercom.
Lieutenant Dominique, track the Admiral's shuttle when he leaves. Let me know which ship he's on.
Sir, we had an Admiral on board? I wasn't informed.
No, Lieutenant, I suspect you weren't. Just track the next outbound shuttle.
Aye, sir.
Keyes looked back on his data pad and reread Ensign Lovell's CSV. He couldn't take back what had happened with Jaggers. There could be no second chance for him. But maybe he could somehow balance the books by giving Lovell another chance. He filled out the necessary paperwork for the transfer request. The forms were long and unnecessarily complex. He transmitted the files to UNSC Perscom and sent a copy directly to Admiral Stanforth's staff.
Sir,
Lieutenant Dominique's voice broke over the intercom.
That shuttle docked with the Leviathan.
Put it on screen.
The screen over his desk snapped on to Camera 5, the aft starboard view. Among the dozens of ships in orbit around Sigma Octanus IV, he easily spotted the Leviathan. She was one of the 20 UNSC cruisers left in the fleet. A cruiser was the most powerful warship ever built by human hands, and Keyes knew they were being slowly pulled out of forward areas and parked in reserve to guard the inner colonies. A piece of shadow moved under the great warship, black moving on black. It revealed itself for only an instant in the sunlight, then slithered back into the darkness. It was a prowler. Those stealth ships were used exclusively by naval intelligence. A cruiser and an ONI presence here? Now Keyes knew there was more going on here than a simple morale boost. He tried not to think about it. It was best not to go too far when questioning the intentions of one superior officer, especially when that officer was an admiral, and especially not when naval intelligence was literally lurking in the shadows. Keyes poured himself another 3 fingers of scotch, set his head on his desk, just to rest his eyes for a moment. The last few hours had drained him.
"Sir!"
Dominique's voice over the intercom woke Captain Keyes.
"Incoming fleet-wide transmission on Alpha Priority Channel."
Keyes sat up and ran his hand over his face. He glanced at the brass clock affixed over his bunk. He had slept for almost 6 hours. Admiral Stanforth appeared on screen.
"Listen up, ladies and gentlemen. We've just detected a large number of Covenant ships massing on the edge of the system. We estimate 10 ships.
On screen, the silhouettes of the all-too-familiar Covenant frigates and a destroyer appeared as ghostly radar smears.
"We'll remain where we are," the Admiral continued. "There's no need to charge in and have those ugly bastards take a shortcut through slipspace and undercut us. Make your ships ready for battle. We've got probes gathering more data. I'll update you when we know more. Stanforth out."
The screen went black. Keyes snapped on the intercom.
"Lieutenant Hall, what's our repair and refit status?"
"Sir,"
she replied,
"engines are operational, but only with a backup coolant system. We can heat them to 50%. Archer and nuclear ordnance resupply is complete. MAC guns are also operational. Repairs to lower decks have just started."
"Inform the dockmaster to pull his crew out," Captain Keyes said. "We're leaving the cradle. When we are clear, fire the reactors to 50%. Go to battle stations."
Chapter 19. 0600 hours, July 18, 2542, military calendar. Sigma Octanus 4, grid 13 by 24.
"Faster!"
Corporal Harlan shouted.
"You want to die in the mud, Marine?"
"Hell no, sir!"
Private Fletcher stomped on the accelerator, and the Warthog's tires spun in the stream bed. They caught, and the vehicle fishtailed through the gravel, across the bank, and onto the sandy shore. Harlan strapped himself into the rear of the Warthog, one hand clamped onto the vehicle's massive 50-millimeter chain gun. Something moved in the brush behind them. Harlan fired a sustained burst. The deafening sound from Old Faithful shook the teeth in his head. Ferns, trees, and vines exploded and splintered as the gunfire scythed through the foliage. Then nothing was moving anymore. Fincher sent the Warthog bouncing along the shore, his head bobbing from side to side as he strained to see through the downpour.
"We're sitting ducks in here, Corporal!"
Fincher yelled.
"We have to get out of this hole and back onto the ridge, sir!"
Corporal Harlan looked for a way out of this river gorge.
"Walker!"
He shook Private Walker in the passenger seat, but Walker didn't respond. He clutched their last jackhammer rocket launcher with a death grip, his eyes staring blankly ahead. Walker hadn't said a word since this mission went south. Harlan hoped that he would snap out of it. He already had one man down. The last thing he needed was for his heavy weapons specialist to be a brain case. Private Cochran lay at the corporal's feet, cradling his gut with blood-smeared hands. He'd caught fire during the ambush.
The aliens used some kind of projectile weapon that fired long, thin needles, which exploded seconds after impact. Cochran's insides were meat. Walker and Fincher had filled him up with biofoam and taped him up. They even managed to stop the bleeding. But if the man didn't get to a medic soon, he was a goner. They had all almost been goners. The squad had left Firebase Bravo 2 hours ago. Satellite images showed the way was all clear to their target area. Lieutenant McCaskey had even said it was a milk run. They were supposed to set up motion sensors on grid 13x24. Just see what was there and get back. A simple snoop job, the LT had called it. What no one told McCaskey was that the satellites weren't penetrating the rain and jungle canopy of the swamp ball too well. If the lieutenant had thought about it, like Corporal Harland was thinking about it now, he would have figured something was wrong with sending 3 squads on a milk run. The squad wasn't green. Corporal Harland and the others had fought the Covenant before. They knew how to kill grunts. When they massed by the hundreds, they knew to call in air support. They'd even taken down a few of the Covenant jackals, the ones with energy shields. You had to flank those guys, take them out with snipers. But none of that had prepared them for this mission. They had done all the right things, damn it. The lieutenant had even gotten their warthogs 5 clicks down the stream bed before the terrain became too steep and slippery for the all-terrain armored vehicles. He had the men hump the rest of the way in on foot. They moved soft and silent, almost crawling all the way through the slime to the depression they were supposed to check out. When they had gotten to the place, it wasn't just another mud-filled sinkhole. A waterfall splashed into a grotto pool. Arches had been carved into the wall, their edges extremely weathered. There were a few scattered paving stones around the pool, and covering those stones were tiny geometric carvings. That's all Corporal Harland got a look at before the lieutenant ordered him and his team to fall back. He wanted them to set up the motion sensors where they had a clear line of sight to the sky. That's probably why they were still alive. The blast had knocked Harland and his team into the mud. They ran to where they had left the lieutenant, found fused glassy mud, a crater, and a few burning corpses and bits of carbonized skeleton. They saw one other thing, an outline in the mist. It was biped, but much larger than any human Harland had ever seen, and oddly it looked like it was wearing armor reminiscent of medieval plate mail. It even carried a large, strangely shaped metal shield. Harland saw the glow of a regenerating plasma weapon, and that's all he needed to see to order a full-speed retreat. Harland, Walker, Cochran, and Fincher fell back, running, blindly firing their assault rifles. Covenant grunts had followed them, peppering the air with those needle guns, mowing down the jungle as the tiny razor shards exploded. Harland and the others stopped and hit the deck, splashing into the thick red mud, as a Covenant Banshee passed them overhead. When they got back on their feet, Cochran took the round in the stomach. The grunts had caught up to them. Cochran flinched, his side exploded, and then he crumpled to the ground. He fell into shock so fast he didn't even have time to scream. Harland, Fincher, and Walker hunkered down and returned fire. They killed a dozen of the little bastards, but more kept coming, their barks and growls echoing through the jungle.
"Cease fire!"
the corporal had ordered. He waited a second, then tossed a grenade when the grunts got closer. Their ears still ringing, they ran, dragging Cochran with them and not looking back. Somehow they had returned to the warthog and gotten the hell out of there. Or at least that's what they were trying to do.
"Over there,"
Fincher said, and pointed to a clearing in the trees.
"That's gotta lead to the ridge. Go!"
Harland said. The warthog slid sideways, then raced up the embankment, caught air, and landed on soft jungle loam. Fincher dodged a few trees and ran the warthog up the slope. They emerged on the ridgeline.
"Jesus, that was close," Harland said.
He ran a muddy hand through his hair, slicking it back. He tapped Fincher on the shoulder. Fincher jumped.
"Private, pull over. Try to raise Firebase Bravo on the narrow band."
"Yes, sir,"
Fincher answered in a wavering voice. He glanced at the near catatonic Private Walker and shook his head. Harland checked on Cochran. Private Cochrane's eyes fluttered open, cracking the mud caked onto his face.
We back it, Corporal?
Almost, Harlan replied. Cochrane's pulse was steady, although his face had, in the last several minutes, drained of color. The wounded man looked like a corpse.
Damn it, Harlan thought. He's gonna bleed out.
Harlan placed a reassuring hand on Cochrane's shoulder.
Hang in there. We'll patch you up as soon as we get to camp.
They had dropships at Bravo. Cochrane had a chance, albeit a slim one, if they got him back to the combat surgeons at headquarters, or better yet, to the Navy docks on the orbiting ships. For a moment, Harlan was dazzled with visions of clean sheets, hot meals, and a meter of armor between him and the Covenant.
Nothing but static on the link, sir,
Fincher said, breaking through Harlan's reverie.
Maybe the radio got hit, Harlan muttered. You know, those explosive needles throw a bunch of micro-shrapnel. We probably got slivers of that stuff inside us, too.
Fincher examined his muscular forearms.
Great! Move out, Harlan said.
The tires of the Warthog spun, gripped, and the vehicle moved rapidly along the ridge. The terrain looked familiar. Harlan even spotted three sets of Warthog tracks. Yes, this was the way the lieutenant had brought them. 10 minutes and they'd be back on base. No more worries. He relaxed, took out a pack of cigarettes and shook one out. He pulled off the safety strip and tapped the end to ignite it. Fincher revved the engine and shot up to the top of the ridge, crossed over, and skidded to a halt. If not for the haze, they would have seen everything from this side of the valley. The lush carpet of jungle in the valley, the river meandering through it, and on the far set of hills, a clearing dotted with fixed gun emplacements, razor wire, and prefab structures. Firebase Bravo. Their platoon had partially dug into the hillside to minimize the camp's footprint and provide a place where they could safely store their munitions and bunk down. A ring of sensors encircled the camp so nothing could sneak up on them. Radar and motion detectors linked to surface-to-air missile batteries. A road ran along the far ridge. 3 clicks down that was the coastal city, Côte d'Azur. The sun broke through the haze overhead, and Corporal Harlan saw everything had changed. It wasn't fog or haze. Smoke rose in columns from the valley, and there was no more jungle. Everything had been burned to the ground. The entire valley was blackened into smoldering charcoal. Glowing red craters honeycombed the hillsides. He fumbled with his binoculars, brought them to his eyes, and froze. The hill where the camp had been was gone. It had been flattened. Only a mirror surface remained. The sides of the adjacent hills glistened with a cracked glass coating. The air was thick with tiny Covenant flyers in the distance. On the ground, grunts and jackals searched for survivors. A few Marines ran for cover. There were hundreds of wounded and dead on the ground, helpless, screaming, some of them trying to crawl away.
"What have you got, sir?"
Fincher asked. The cigarette fell from Harlan's mouth and caught in his shirt, but he didn't take his eyes off the battlefield to brush it away.
"There's nothing left," he whispered.
A shape moved in the valley, much larger than the other grunts and jackals. Its outline was blurry. Harlan tried to focus the binoculars on it, but couldn't. It was the same thing he had seen at grid 13x24. The grunts gave it a wide berth. The thing lifted its arm. Its whole arm looked like one big gun, and a bolt of plasma struck near the riverbank. Even from this distance, Harlan heard the screams of the men who had been hiding there.
"Jesus!" He dropped the binoculars. "We're bugging out right now," he said. "Turn this beast around, Fincher."
"But..."
"They're gone," Harlan whispered. "They're all dead."
Walker whimpered and rocked back and forth.
"We'll be dead too unless you move," Harlan said. "We already got lucky once today. Let's not push it."
"Yeah."
Fincher reversed the Warthog.
"Yeah, some luck."
He sped back down the hillside and hopped the Warthog off the embankment and back into the stream bed.
"Follow the river,"
Harlan told him.
"It'll take us all the way to HQ.
A shadow crossed their path. Harlan twisted around and saw a pair of stubby-winged Covenant Banshees swooping down after them.
"Move it!"
he screamed at Fincher. Fincher floored the warthog, and plumes of water sprayed in their wake. They bounced over rocks and fishtailed across the stream. Bolts of plasma hit the water next to them, exploding into steam. Rock shards pinged off the armored side of the vehicle.
"Walker!"
Harlan shouted.
"Use those jackhammers!"
Walker huddled, doubled over in his seat. Harlan fired the chain gun. Tracers cut through the air. The flyers nimbly dodged them. The heavy machine gun was only accurate at reasonably short ranges, and not even that with Fincher bouncing the warthog all over the place.
"Walker!"
he cried.
"We are going to die if you don't get those missiles into the air!"
He would have ordered Fincher to grab the launcher, but he'd have to stop to grab it. That, or try to drive with no hands. If the warthog stopped, they'd be sitting ducks for those flyers. Harlan glanced at the riverbanks. They were too steep for the warthog. They were stuck in the river with no cover.
"Walker, do something!"
Corporal Harlan fired the chain gun again until his arms went numb. It was no good. The Banshees were too far away, too quick. Another plasma bolt hit, directly in front of the warthog. Heat washed over Harlan. Blisters pinpricked.